What I do is I just try to take my hat and I turn it around, and it's like a switch that goes on. And when the switch goes on, I feel like another person. I feel like a truck, like a machine.
I saw it on Linden Street.
Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. Now, this isn't your standard film review. Rather, it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with a little bit of background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Now, fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review, subscribe. Our season-long theme, The Summer of Canon, just continues to roll on, and this week, the LSCE preps to see the 1987 arm-wrestling cult classic, Over the Top. Join us! I remember first seeing this film back in 1996. I was in junior high, and I was hanging out at my grandparents' house, half-heartedly working on a school project about the state of Connecticut, all the while watching in the background with my cousins and siblings as we sat on the couch with TV trays in the living room, taking in the WGN Saturday afternoon movie, which happened to be this week's offering. We're all just killing time, waiting to actually go out that evening to see a community musical that my father was going to be playing in that night. So, truthfully, we were just coming up with something to do, enjoying ourselves, and cracking each other up, with my brother and myself both agreeing that my younger cousin Michael, for the record, did the best quote of Stallone from this film, explaining to us how, you know, when he turns his hat, it's like flipping a switch. Years later, when I watched it again with my wife, we both agreed it was a cheesy film, and it was still a lot of fun to sit through and take in, provided you went into the movie with the right frame of mind. All that said, though, if we're going to really talk about this week's film, we have to actually go back to when it was first conceived. 1977, nearly a decade before its release. Over the Top was first dreamt up long before the Go-Go Boys were even in the picture stateside, back in the late 1970s. Indeed, the bones of the story were first formed in 1977, when the original script for what would become Over the Top first came about as a vehicle for actor Gary Conway. Who? Well, of course, Gary Conway. Conway, at that point, had been on the ABC television series Land of the Giants, and he had been getting some heat from starring in a drive-through B-movie vengeance tale that was 1977's The Farmer. Conway was looking for a new project that he would have a hand in creating, basically something that would help boost his status. So he tried to reach out to screenwriter David Engelbach to help him complete a script idea that he had, a story of an arm wrestling trucker who would travel around the country and who would eventually wind up competing in a tournament just to prove himself. Engelbach, himself a former assistant to Steven Spielberg on the little movie called Jaws, agreed to help him tighten the story up, in exchange, of course, for the privilege of actually directing the picture, once they got funding. It was Engelbach who had expanded and then refocused the story about the trucker's attempt to reconnect with his estranged 12-year-old son, changing the tone of the feature completely, but simultaneously making it a little more palatable for mainstream audiences. The duo first attempted to pitch their film to Columbia, but they passed on it, and then it got rejected soundly all around Hollywood. That is, until they stumbled across the newly minted Canon Film Group under the leadership of the Go-Go Boys. For his part, Menachem Golan loved the story so much that he bought the screenplay and then he held it aside in development to save it as a film that he would purposely direct himself, cutting Engelbach out of the original deal, but offering him up another project to work on in an attempt to smooth things over, which would later have him working on some of the Death Wish films before Golan gave him the opportunity to helm his very own outing as a director with 1986's goofy post-apocalyptic sci-fi film, America 3000. Over time, Conway, the man who specifically wrote this to actually be a vehicle for himself, was cut out of the project entirely, with the Go-Go Boys wanting to go with a bigger name to star in this newly acquired intellectual property. Although, again, they worked with Conway to keep him happy. They gave him other opportunities. They let him write sequels for them. He penned both the screenplays for American Ninja 2 and American Ninja 3, and he even got to star as the villain in the former of those. Still, as the years wore on and 1984 eventually rolled around, flush with success from films like Breakin', the Go-Go Boys thought it was time that they would dust off this script and start playing their hand at recruiting some sort of outside, big Hollywood actor who could join them on this project. This was going to be their ticket to being that massive seventh major studio in the industry, if they could play their cards right, that was, and get a name that carried the proper amount of gravity and weight. So they felt their investment deserved someone with A-list status. First, starting by courting Don Johnson, who at the time was white hot from his regular gig as Crockett on the hit NBC crime drama Miami Vice. Johnson wasn't interested, though, in what the Go-Go Boys were pitching back in 84, so Menachem Golan himself had to be a bit creative. He was, and yes, I know after the last few episodes I acknowledged and I sound like a broken record, he's gonna ignore those sensible rules that he had established in their model at the time. You know, where they kept things small, they put stars on retainer and pay them peanuts. No, this time he was gonna break the mold. He was gonna go out there and coerce a big star that he could find with a large payday. And at the time, he thought he was gonna coerce the biggest star that he could think of. And who in the mid-1980s was larger than Sylvester Stallone? And seriously, why not Sly? I mean, the man was the number one action star for the decade. He was one of the top box office draws at that, successfully cranking out sequels to both Rocky and Rambo franchises respectively, which were themselves so big that Canon was making those missing in action pictures just to buy into the genre and rip it off for themselves. At this point in time, getting Stallone in a picture was considered to be a lock on having box office success. But the Go-Go Boys of 1984 had a little bit of a problem. While they were having very much a successful run, these were still the salad days of them being flush and semi-prudent about the cash that they would spend. If they were going to land Stallone, they were going to have to drop what amounted to a money bomb on the actor to get his attention. Now, something we have to consider. At this point, not that movie stars were paid poorly by any stretch, but in the mid-80s, your typical A-list actor was getting several million dollars to take a role up on the big screen, and that was just it. Well, we can thank the cousins, Golan and Globus, for changing that paradigm and their attempt to buy their way into Hollywood legitimacy. Because when they lured Stallone to come on board to their arm wrestling picture by promising him that they would pay him, at the time, an exorbitant $12 million to star, or if we were to put it in today's dollars, that means he would have taken $36 million sight unseen. Whew, that really broke the mold. Here's a slight problem, though. The Go-Go Boys of Canon didn't actually have that kind of cash on hand. So what they did was they placed Sylvester Stallone in a holding deal. They paid him $500,000 to keep him attached on retainer, and then Golan was banking on the fact that he would have his cousin, Globus, go out there and raise funds that would both end up covering paying for Stallone's salary himself and would recoup that remaining $11.5 million. Plus, he would have to raise the funds to cover an additional $12 million that it would take to make the film proper. Now, you getting all that? Good. Let's jump ahead to 1986. As we know from past episodes leading up to this point, Cannon Under the Boys had been getting away from their scrappy original roots, and they'd started to spend a lot of money and expand their business and their slate of cinematic offerings in a very short amount of time. And in doing so, they were routinely getting away from their small picture model. Between the purchase of EMI, the theater chains, both in Europe and America, and a new office building, for men who prided themselves on their frugality and their practicality, this was entirely new territory. But as they were working on this film, they figured this was a gamble that they could take. The summer of 1986 saw Cannon Group stock trading at $45.50 a share, so why not let everything roll and take a shot? 1986, though, would wrap up, and Cannon would end the year not having a single major hit to brag about. Worse, the company, by the fiscal year's end, was $5.8 million in the red. The standard low-budget fare model suddenly wasn't paying off. Heck, the last Chuck Norris picture they had put out, Firewalker, had tanked for them at the box office. Adding to the mounting fears, the Security and Exchange Commission had started to come around and ask questions about how Cannon was using its books and some rather loose accounting policies when it came to tracking the money it made on its films. How can you claim a film was a hit and yet say at the same time it wasn't profitable? The third quarter alone saw Cannon report a loss of $14.6 million on revenue of $77 million. In contrast, in 1985, for the same quarter that year, they showed a profit of $3.3 million on a revenue of $34.3 million. Something was wrong. Desperate for some quick cash to keep things going, the Go-Go Boys were forced to start selling off some of those newly acquired assets just to give themselves liquidity to pay off these new projects and keep the lights on. They ended up striking a deal with Warner Communications that netted them a desperate $75 million that would allow them to stay open and in production. Warner Brothers would get the home video rights to over 25 Cannon Library films, plus they would get a percentage of the European theater chain, and they ended up buying stock in the company itself, walking away owning 15% of Cannon Film Group outright. Cannon was now hard-pressed and hoping that their big film with Stallone, as well as their other acquisitions of number of large budget franchises, would really hit big on the screen in 1987. Things like Superman and Masters of the Universe, those all would pay off huge at the box office, and of course it would pull them out of their deepening financial mire that they found themselves stuck in. Humbled, at least initially, Golan issued a press release that announced that in 1987, Cannon was going to cut down its production schedule and it would only be producing 12 to 15 movies that year. And in a move that signaled there was blood in the water to fellow studios, they announced equally plans to lay off over 250 employees. To finally raise enough cash to get this week's film completed and to get the full $25 million for financing, Cannon resorted to a rather shameless form of product placement, taking cash from companies like Pepsi, Budweiser, Soloflex, Duracell, Alka-Seltzer, Pizza Hut, Carl's Jr., TWA, Volvo, Brute, and Valvoline, all to get enough cash to shoot this movie. Now, I can hear you out there. Wait, Sylvester Stallone has been called many things. A megalomaniac, a misogynist. He's been accused of being arrogant to a fault. But almost everybody would agree he was nobody's fool. Why would he agree to jump on board on a project with Cannon at this point? Well, two reasons. First, he was accepting their money and it was good pay. And more importantly, the second reason was personal. While his movies were insanely profitable and he was a genuine action star, critics had been accusing him of being, well, somewhat of a Johnny One Note, and noting that a lot of his pictures were violent and intellectually lazy, and worse, not geared towards families who were trying to find something to go see at the cinema. Stallone's own children at the time were in their preteens, and he was really looking for a project that he could use to connect with them. A film that could be seen and enjoyed by families, as well as a wide array of viewers. And since he demanded that he would essentially get a crack at a complete rewrite of Engelbach's script, He then went even further and expanded on that main character of Lincoln Hawk with his writing partner, Sterling Siliphant, pitching the remorseful man that audiences could relate to, a tough but sensitive, caring father who is desperate to try to reconnect with his son, being really the sole focus of this story, with arm wrestling and trucking just being the means to an end. Golan, true to his word, saw to the directing of this film for Cannon personally, although there had been many a rumor that Stallone initially offered to take a lesser deal, something like $10 million, if Golan would just let him direct the movie himself. But no, the Israeli wanted to hold control, so they paid the $12 million check. When it came to casting, though, they put some really good effort in here. You, of course, have Stallone as our lead, he's Lincoln Hawk, but you need to have a really good child actor to play off of. A believable kid who is smart, but could do coddled and in need of fatherly guidance. To fill the role of Michael, actor David Mendenhall was cast. Now, Mendenhall was a seasoned child actor at this point. He had been on shows like General Hospital as a regular. For you Taxi fans out there who are not just me and my father, Mendenhall played Elaine Nardo's son Jason on the series and showed up in several episodes there. But if you're of a certain age, like I am, you were probably introduced to him one of two ways. Either you caught him in the great cheesy 1983 Roger Corman Star Wars ripoff, Space Raiders, which I did back in the day, or, and even better, because I did too, you heard his voice playing Daniel Witwicky. That would be Spike Witwicky's son on the wonderful animated series Transformers. Actress Susan Blakely, of Rich Man Poor Man fame, had already worked with Stallone herself on The Lords of Flatbush. She was cast here to play Christina Hawk, our main character's estranged dying wife. Veteran character actor Robert Loggia, for some unknown reason, agreed to star as the cantankerous and driven Jason Cutler, the villainous grandfather who wants to claim Michael for himself and who hates our main character's guts. But every film needs a really, really big bad, and in this case, when it comes to the actual arm wrestling, they got an honest-to-goodness arm wrestling champion, Rick Zumwalt, to appear here as Bob Bull Hurley, the man who really has it out for Hawk and wants that championship money for himself. Shooting would take place over the summer of 1986, starting on June 9th and wrapping by August 15th, with locations spread out across the Great American West, including California, Utah, Colorado, and of course, Las Vegas, Nevada. For you classic TV fans out there, the Cutler Mansion that is shown so many times is none other than the Bel Air Mansion that was used for all the exterior shots on the television series The Beverly Hillbillies. So, you know, it's pretty much quality. During the shooting, though, there were, well, let's call them some interesting interpretations on how things would exactly work. Golan would find himself often having heated discussions with various members of the crew, who would point out to him things that weren't exactly following the script. Case in point, during an arm wrestling semi-final scene, the lights up behind the competitors read, "Finals," which the script girl then came on set and pointed out, "Hey, this is inaccurate. We're shooting the semi-finals. That's why we have four sets of competitors." Golan wheeled and started to yell, "You need to read the script better." He ended up snapping, "Don't you understand? It's the finals. Finals is four. When it's two, that's the championships. This is finals." Pushing back against Golan's, well, let's call them talents, Stallone himself was a man who had directed a film or two in his day and knew what he was talking about, especially since he had rewritten this script entirely now. The crew would often refer to the film production as the warring trailers instead of over the top, noting the hard differences in ideas held between the director and the star. Stallone would loudly throw out suggestions, asking Golan in the middle of a setup why he was doing something the way he was doing it, and then would point out, "Well, you know, if I was the director on this picture, I would do it this way." And that would usually mollify the fiery Israeli into having him acquiesce to his star's demands. To be fair, contractually, he had to. Because even though Golan thought what was going on the screen was his vision, he had given Stallone final cut of the picture. So at best, the director was just a figurehead on his own film. At one point, the director turned to tell extras in Las Vegas that they needed to be more discreet in the scene, with some of them thinking he meant they needed to be more artful. And that's when Stallone walked by and jokingly said, very playfully, to the director, "Nothing about canon is discreet." Then he laughed and sort of joshingly punched him in the arm and said, "But you're getting better every day." Now, in hindsight, actor David Mendenhall would claim that there wasn't as much tension on the set that other people have said. At least according to him, it was a very familial atmosphere, and that Stallone and Golan got along great, with the director clearly running the show. I would say perhaps we should chalk up his interpretation to the fact that you have a child actor having a kick-ass summer filming a movie with Sylvester Stallone, and he was shielded from some of the harsher realities of the business on the set, because many other people have stated to the contrary. Oh, and I would be completely remiss if I didn't mention the musical talent that was retained for this film. Now, the score itself was done by Italian composer Giorgio Moroder, but the soundtrack itself is a collection of some massive power ballads that just could be extruded into a water bottle and then labeled 100% pure 80s. Songs from Sammy Hagar, Eddie Money, Larry Green, Big Trouble, Kenny Loggins, Frank Stallone, and Asia, which I'm sure the youth of today would all consider to be cornball and cheesy, but hey, back in the day, this was hot stuff. All in all said, guys, you've been ever so patient in listening to this idle prattle from me. How's about I shut up and we get to that trailer? What do you say?
What are the odds on Lincoln Hawk's fist?
20 to 1, pal. Be a long shot.
Box, let's go.
The world meets nobody halfway. Remember that.
I don't have a father, sir.
The world has always bet against Lincoln Hawks.
This guy's nothing.
Why'd you leave us?
It won't happen again.
What my grandson found, I don't care how you do it. Do it.
But a winner never listens to the odds.
Whatever happens, I want you to stay with him. Where'd we end up?
Together is all I can guarantee.
You ain't got a prayer in Vegas.
You never had anything, so you have nothing to lose.
All I want to do is hurt him, cripple him, get him off the table.
All I care about is you. You're my boy, you understand?
The world beats nobody halfway. Now is the time to do for yourself.
I love you.
Sylvester Stallone, Over the Top.
We open on genial trucker Lincoln Hawk, as played by Sylvester Stallone, attempting to clean both himself and his worn-out rig up, before he drives over to the prestigious military boarding school where he will pick up his son, Michael Cutler, as played by David Mendenhall, on the request of his estranged wife, Christina, as played by Susan Blakely, to allow the two of them, quote, time to bond. Christina is gravely ill, and she's trying to make things right while she still has time. When Hawk shows up at the academy, both with the proper paperwork and permission from Christina, while the officiant, Colonel Davis, as played by John Braden, is convinced, he ends up verbally sparring with Cadet Cutler, who doesn't trust this man, who he's never seen and has been absent in his life for over a decade.
The Colonel wishes to see me, sir.
Your father wishes to, Cadet.
My father?
Yes, he's come to drive you home.
Hello, Mike.
I don't have a father, sir.
This is your father, Michael.
Sir, my grandfather has instructed me to go home with no one besides himself or my mother.
Your mother has legal custody over you, Cutler, not your grandfather. And it is her request that your father bring you home.
Sir, may I ask a question?
Of course.
May I see some identification on this man, sir?
That's not called for, cadet.
It's okay. I'm ready.
The duo embark on a drive to California together to visit Christina in the hospital. And pretty much from the get-go, young Michael is rude, dismissive, and rather belittling about both Hawk and his truck. Angrily asking his father just where all the pictures of him and his mother came from that are in the cab, and he scoffs when his parent tells him, well, he received them in the mail from correspondences with Christina from all those years. Michael ends up calling his father a liar, questioning why he would write his mother and never write to Michael himself. Hawk, for his part, seems rather stunned and apologizes, claiming that he wrote his son each and every time, plus, of course, birthdays, holidays, you name it. Michael is upset and feigns sickness in an attempt to run away from his father, dangerously exiting the truck and crossing a highway before telling the man that he hates him to his face. Hawk ends up grabbing him and patiently takes it all in stride, telling him fine, they have to start somewhere. Back at the academy, Michael's maternal grandfather, Jason Cutler, as played by Robert Loggia, has arrived, and he is demanding that his grandson be turned back over to him, railing that his sick daughter is in no condition to make such decisions about his grandson, and stating that Hawk is a dangerous degenerate. Wanting to find Michael, he ends up putting out feelers and starts hiring local thugs to find and kidnap the boy to bring him back to California. During their road trip, Hawk takes his son to a diner that offers up what he says are some great steaks. But the boy ends up lecturing him that he needs to eat healthier foods and demands that he has whole wheat toast with tuna salad and lemon water. As they sit and wait for their meal, a burly man named Smasher, as played by Greg Schwartz, approaches them and challenges Hawk to an arm wrestling match, betting him $1,000 that he can take him. Hawk accepts and excuses himself, and the whole diner gets in on the action, with Hawk impressing Michael as he defeats Smasher handily. All of this is quietly witnessed by Bob Bull Hurley, as played by Rick Zumwalt, who wants a piece of Hawk, too.
You got lucky again, huh, Hawks?
How you doing, Bull?
Better than you. Right now, double or nothing, what do you say?
Let's just wait for Vegas.
Come on, let's do it now. I feel like kicking some ass.
Let's wait till Vegas, okay?
You ain't got a prayer in Vegas.
We'll see.
Too bad your old man's yellow, kid. I'll see you in Vegas. Get out of the way. Back up.
Sorry about that, Mike.
You know, you're a hustler. You hustled that man back there for money. I'd like to call my mother.
After the match, Michael demands that he gets to call his mother, trying to get her to let him come home without his dad, parroting back talking points that his grandfather has told him about his father, noting, well, he abandoned us. But Christina pushes back and defends her ex, noting that he's a good man and he had his reasons, and being sick as she is, she wants him to get to see the world and get to know his father. Getting back into the truck cab, Michael accuses his father of being a petty hustler, and he wants to know if he's still a seller of drugs, claiming that grandfather filled him in on all of the facts. Hawk tersely tells his son that, while yes, he made a huge mistake in walking away, he's not the man that Michael's grandfather says he is, and no, he's not a criminal. After spending the night together in the truck cab, the two end up bonding over morning exercise before hitting the open road, where Michael once again starts to run his mouth, telling his father that there's more to life than lifting weights, building his muscles, he should be building his mind, telling him that he's modeling a distinct lack of intelligence.
See how I do this? Put your wrist into it, you lean forward, and you put a lot of weight in there, but you have to use your whole body to it. It's like your whole body is one piece of machinery. You try it. That's it. Good grip. That's it. Lean into it. You can do it. Keep your wrist straight. Good. That's it, Mike. Now put some muscle into it.
There's more to life than just muscles.
Meaning what?
seen any, or I don't see any books around. You don't read much, do you? No offense, but you're just simply on a different social scale.
You want to tell me more about the social scale?
It's been said that the average mental age for an adult is 15, just 3 years older than I am. For a trucker, it has to be in the 11 to 13 year range. Maybe 14, if they have good genetics.
You know, Mike, it's really great driving with such a tremendous intellectual like you. It's a real blessing.
Why are you stopping? You're aggravated, aren't you?
Boy, I passed aggravation about a mile back.
Are you gonna get violent?
Gonna give me a break? You know, Mike, since you think it takes no brains at all, I have to be stupid and abnormal to drive a truck like this, I'll tell you what. Why don't you just come on over into my seat and let's see if you can move this machinery around, okay?
What?
Drive, genius.
Per his father's command, Michael is forced to drive, and while he is apprehensive at first, he actually starts to get into it, noting that driving a truck is a little harder than he thought, but still enjoyable. And the facade starts to crack, and he has some genuine fun with his parent. Stopping for lunch, Hawk tries to impart a lesson to his son, setting him up to have an arm wrestling match with a local tough-looking teen. Michael is afraid, but Hawk insists that he believes in him, telling him that he could take this guy in a best 2 out of 3 match. When Mike loses the first round, he tries to run away in embarrassment, but Hawk stops him and gives him a pep talk.
What are you trying to do?
All you wanted to do was embarrass me. Well, you did it, okay? Grandfather always said you were a loser. Now you're trying to make me one, and I hate you for it.
Mike, I don't care what your grandfather thinks about me, okay? All I care about is you. Now, you lost back there because you beat yourself. You let yourself get beat. I know you can do it. You're a special kid. You're my boy, do you understand? But you're also a spoiled, rich brat who's always had everything done for him. Now it's time to do for yourself, Mike, and you can do it. Because I'm telling you, the world meets nobody halfway. Do you understand what that means? If you want it, Mike, you gotta take it. Do you hear me? You gotta take it. Go in there and try. I know you can win. But even if you don't, so what? So you lose. As long as you lose, like a winner, it doesn't matter. Because you did it with dignity. I'm telling you, if you don't go in there, you're going to be sorry. You're going to regret it your whole life. You know what I mean? Come on. I know you can do it. Will you do it for me? Come on. Let's get it.
Encouraged, Michael goes back and wins both of the next bouts, proudly embracing his father's lessons, and then calling his mother afterwards to brag. Unfortunately, this entire time, Cutler has been tracking them by way of monitoring the calls that are going into his daughter's private hospital room phone line. Michael is thus found by the thugs and abducted, forcing Hawk to give chase, running them down with his truck and eventually getting his son back, telling Michael that he should ask his grandfather why he is being kidnapped. They do eventually arrive in California and head to the hospital to see Christina, only to learn that she has died in surgery that afternoon, causing Michael to turn and blame his father and this entire road trip for delaying him from being able to see his mother one last time before she died. Distraught, Michael hails a cab and goes home to his grandfather's mansion. A funeral is held, and afterwards, Hawk goes to the Cutler mansion to pick up his son, but that's when security will not let him in. So he does the sensible thing and ends up plowing through the main gates with his truck, going in and confronting his father-in-law, who claims that the boy is his, all before security and police end up tackling and beating Hawk, much to Michael's horror. Arrested, Hawk is offered a deal. If he's willing to relinquish custody of Michael, Cutler will not press charges and he can move on with his life. In jail, Mike goes and visits his father and asks him, what exactly would their future be together if he stayed with him? Unable to tell his son that anything in life is certain, especially the life he lives, All Hawk can offer is his love and support. But Mike needs more and asks his father for stability. And Hawk understands that that is something that his son does need. And agreeing to look out for his own best interest, he signs over custody to give Michael a chance. Hawk then travels alone to Las Vegas, where he sells his truck and enrolls in the World Championship arm wrestling competition that is being held at the convention center. Taking all of the money that he has, $7,000, he bets it all on himself to win the tournament at 20-1 odds. Back home, Michael has been snooping through his mother's things, and he discovers a trove of letters that were sent to him over the years, all by his dad, confirming that Hawk was telling him the truth. Wanting to be with him, Michael ends up escaping from the mansion and heads to the airport, catching a flight to Las Vegas, with his grandfather chasing after him. The competition ends up starting, and we're treated to a rocking arm wrestling montage as 500 people compete for over $100,000 in cash and a brand new truck. After a slew of victories, Hawk makes it to the semifinals, where he gets interviewed.
And the newcomer from the Truckers Division, Lincoln Hawk, over here!
Tell you the truth, the truck is the most important thing for me. It doesn't matter if I become the champion or anything. That's not the most important. I need this truck.
During his next arm wrestling match, Hawk goes up against the massive competitor John Grizzly, as played by Bruce Way, and he loses the first bout. But with double elimination rules in effect, he still has a chance to set things right. And he does so, winning two more times, although at the cost of severely hurting his arm. During a break in between the matches, Hawk ends up being summoned to a hotel suite by Cutler to talk things over and, of course, to receive an offer.
You want a drink? You don't have to stay sharp. I understand you already lost your first match.
What do you want, Cutler?
We don't have to be enemies.
I never wanted to be your enemy.
All right, then. Let's get right to it. With Christina gone, I have no family left in my life, except for Michael. You never had anything, so you have nothing to lose. Hawk, you can believe what you want to, but you're a deserter, plain and simple. You deserted your wife and your son.
You were tearing us apart.
Don't try to clear your conscience at my expense. You're a liar. You deserted them.
We finished.
I'm not through with you yet. Come on outside. I want to show you something. Come on! There in the parking lot, in front of the hotel. That's the finest rig that money can buy. If you want it, it's yours. Here's a check for $500,000. Take it and get the hell out of my life.
What are you trying to do? I gave you custody of the boy. I signed papers. What more do you want?
I'm trying to make things easy for you, Hawk. You don't need Michael as a meal ticket anymore. You're on a free ride. So take the truck. Take the money. Start a new life. Start your own family.
Start a family. This is over. I'm coming again.
You're going back on your word.
Yeah.
You signed over custody, and Michael will never go with you because you're a loser. You've always been a loser!
After accusing Hawk of abandoning his family, Cutler desperately tries to buy him off from ever seeing Michael again, something Hawk will not agree to, telling Cutler to his face, "When this thing is over, he's going to fight Cutler in court for the boy." With the semifinals still going, Hawk is cheered on by Michael from the wings as he takes on the Teamster-backed contender, Harry Bosco, as played by Sam Scarber, before making it into the finals, squaring off against Bull Hurley. Worried about actually being able to win, Hawk considers quitting, but Michael parrots back to him the same pep talk that his father gave, telling him he isn't a loser and he doesn't care that he's a trucker. He just wants to travel the road and live with him from now on. Inspired, Hawk goes on to face Bull, making for a hard struggle. When they end up becoming separated from their clench, a belt is then tied around each of their hands to ensure that they will have a proper outcome. Bull, for his part, attempts to throw his whole weight down, but Hawk is able to get the upper hand in the end, rethreading his finger lock and pulling Bull over the top, persevering. Cutler, seeing father and son celebrate their victory, abandons his plans to pursue custody of Michael, allowing the triumphant pair to leave Vegas the next day with a new truck and over $300,000 in cash, and a goal between the two of them to start their own trucking business their own way, Hawk and Son. As they drive out of Vegas and into the future, credits roll. Good Lord, where do we even begin with this one? Okay, for the record, I've said it before, I'll say it here again. I like this movie. It's fun. It has some great moments, but man, as a story, I would be lying to you if I could say anything that would be contrary to the utmost truth, because face it, the logic for this film does not work at all. Like, at all. To say the story is half-baked is being kind. Lincoln Hawk is a dad who just, quote, went away because granddad was tearing them apart. Oh, okay, fine, we can follow that thread, but why not stick around? Why not stay together? Or, hey, better yet, why not all of you leave as a unit, leaving granddad behind, rather than have it go down the way it went down? I know, you're not supposed to go pulling plot threads like this, but the logic here for just about every relationship setup is asinine. Hawk already has full custody of his son, so then him not being able to enter the domicile to pick him up? Great. Don't flip out, don't ram your car through the front gate, call the police. It's like these characters we've seen up until the very moment need to do something incredibly extreme and the opposite of what a logical, competent person would do in such a situation. Or hey, take it from this different approach. Cutler, he wants Michael to come back to California, and he goes to all these crazy lengths to hire thugs to go collect his grandson. But he's also very much aware that Hawk and Michael are literally driving to California with the goal of getting into town at a very specific time and date to see Christina post-surgery. So, if Cutler wants Michael to come back to California, he literally just has to wait 2 days and his grandson will be right there. Which kind of makes all of these kidnapping attempts seem, well, pointless. Now, that being said, Robert Loggia as an actor, he's a really great sport for this film, especially one that doesn't give him much to do other than to, like, growl and grimace, rant and rave like a madman. Although the script doesn't exactly give him much to work with, he still goes for the gold here as the hateful Jason Cutler.
Mike! Mike!
Come with me, please.
Mike, please. Do you actually think that you can get away with what you've done? You think you can come in here, destroy my home, and take Michael with you? Michael Cutler is my boy! You've deserted him years ago, and that's a fact that you can't change, no matter what you do! Damn you!
Damn you.
Dad! Dad! Come on, let him go!
Come on, let
him go!
Come on, let
him go!
For his part, Stallone does indeed try to convey the excitement and sport of arm wrestling in a fashion that, well, makes sense when you see it on the big screen, it's a little harder to convey right here. But that's exactly where we get this sort of nonsensical aspect of it. The ever-important, lovingly applied, re-threaded finger lock that Lincoln Hawk uses to beat his opponents. Yeah, you heard me. To beat a really tough competitor, just when it looks like he's going to potentially lose, Lincoln Hawk will undo and re-thread his fingers around his competition's hand and use that new grip to somehow overpower his competitor's bicep and, more impressively, the rest of their arm to show that something has indeed happened. Now, to the credit of... I'm actually going to have to give Stallone this one, because I've seen Golan direct action sequences in other films, and it didn't ever look like this. Plus, I mean, Stallone got Final Cut, as we already talked about, so this is all Stallone. He takes something that should be inherently sort of boring to watch, and he absolutely makes it explosive when we get to see two guys having an arm wrestling sequence. Now, that being said, I'll say this too. Stallone, for his part, is rather subdued here. He absolutely achieves his goal of offering up a performance that could be understood and enjoyed by a wide audience. He gives an actual, decent, I would even say better performance than this film deserves, although it doesn't really know what to call him. His character is addressed throughout the film both as Lincoln Hawk, which is the screenplay version of his name, and yet other characters, especially when they're yelling at him, will scream and address him as Hawks! You gotta pick a lane, folks.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Are you still dealing drugs, sir? Are you?
You think of that all by yourself, Mike?
My grandfather gave me the facts.
Truth is, I never did what your grandfather said I did, Mike. Only mistake I ever made was leaving. I admit that. So how'd you like the arm wrestling match back there?
It's an experience.
Sure was.
Still, there are things that are just inherently comical about this film, and unintentionally so. For my money, it's the letter-reading montage. Now, I'll say this, I've seen many a montage in my day, but I've never just seen a kid reading. I mean, seriously, we watch a kid beam vacantly for a solid 4 minutes while a montage of his hands sorting through papers, holding cards up, rolls, and just watching his head bob and his eyes move as he supposedly happily reads. Yeah, it's intercut with Hawk selling his truck and entering the competition, and yes, the 80s was a quintessential time for this sort of storytelling trope, but usually when we get a montage, it's done to quickly show how things are coming together. My mind is drawn immediately to, like, Footloose. That movie uses a ton of them. Like, when the kids are all practicing their dancing, or when we see them gathering together to clean up the old grain mill for the prom. You know, it's just people shown sweeping, moving, painting, doing things, and what we're left with is a final result. But here, all we're left with is watching David Mendenhall grinning like a rube at a country fair, while paper gets shuffled back and forth, and Kenny Loggins' Meet Me Halfway blasts. That does not a proper time span make. Also, the entire time, I have to point this out, Mom's been in possession of these letters. They're addressed to both her and Michael. So it's Mom that never shared these letters with him, not Granddad. This entire time we're supposed to be hating on Robert Loggia's character, but it's Christina who didn't take the time to let her son know that he had a father out there who cared about him and who was writing to him for over a decade. Now, some have floated, perhaps it was Gramps that was holding all of this information back, but then why would it be in Mom's bureau in her bedroom? I get it, you need to have a bad guy, and while you can have a film that has multiple bad guys, which we're supposed to be pulling from here, you know, it still seems a bit weird to have both Cutler and Bull Hurley trying to dominate for who can be worse. Cutler hates Hawk, drives him away because he doesn't think he's good enough for his daughter, but then he also simultaneously belittles him for leaving? It would seem that Hawk leaving would be exactly what the old man would want in this scenario, so why does he spend all of his time ranting about going as he does? Bull Hurley, at least his hatred makes sense. He wants to win that prize money, he wants the truck, he's gonna intimidate Hawk to do so, he's gonna try to beat Hawk. Seriously, this movie doesn't know what it wants to be, so it almost feels like the story changes scene by scene just to fit that moment. So, I can hear you out there now. Chris, how was this film received? In short, not very well. I mean, what did you expect? This was setting you up. We've talked about how 87 was going to be a rough year. Why should this film be any different? Variety's Cart was semi-positive with his assessment. While he considered this to be a cookie-cutter script, specifically calling it a melodrama that was routinely made in almost every aspect, he at least noted that Stallone was very likable here in a tale about filial affection and arm wrestling. And although he clearly missed the mark when he opined that he thought audiences would go for this sort of hokum, despite the predictability based on performances past, citing that Stallone was at least sincere and soulful, and Mendenhall was a likable tyke. Justice got served at the end. You could see a lot worse films in the last year or so. That was the one Shining review I could actually find, and I use Shining very loosely. Everybody else? Oof. Dave Kerr of the Chicago Tribune was a little more neutral. He says the sole objective in designing a Sylvester Stallone vehicle is to make it as much like the last one as possible. There's a certain amount of latitude that's allowed between the surly violence of Rambo and the sweet, tempered violence of Rocky, but otherwise, the film has to follow a sort of strict outline for the, quote, Stallone formula. 75 minutes, build up to a big fight, 20 minutes for the fight itself, and then peppered throughout a great many earnest lectures on the importance of believing in oneself. Although he does acknowledge that the ending, the editing, and the lighting all feel distinctly like Stallone himself had a hand in shooting it, he notes that it's this trademark buildup of pacing for a fight sequence that one would see similarly in any movie that is showing a sex act. Eek, great. Bring the kids, tell them it's just like watching people have sex on screen. That's gonna really win them over for the arm wrestling movie. His awkward, but not actually incorrect analogy aside, other critics were not as neutral in their assessment. You see, Janet Maslin of New York Times did open her review saying that, you know, it took colossal crust. Sidebar, since when has anyone said crust when they wanted to make it synonymous with balls? Just say balls, lady. More specifically than it took Sylvester Stallone to make a film that is largely about arm wrestling, which isn't that exciting to watch. And it's not the sport of kings either. Maslin notes that the screenplay doesn't make any sense, and astutely mentions that while the film does seem to advocate that reason is a really good first approach to solving any problem, all-out destruction is the next best thing when that can't happen. Rob Salem of the Toronto Star was equally wildly dismissive of the film. Let's not waste any time here. He wins, okay? He runs the gauntlet, he rises to the occasion, he dreams the impossible dream, he beats the odds, he takes the cake, he emerges triumphant, and he rides off into the sunset to live happily ever after. He then follows up with a swipe at other Stallone films, noting, actually, Over the Top serves as a sort of all-out apology for both Cobra and Rambo, a return to the kind of sappy underdog makes good sentiment of Stallone's early Rocky period. This time, however, perhaps because he's sick of lugging around all the heavy artillery, and perhaps because he's still sore from the beating he took from Rocky IV, our hero must enter the fray armed only with, well, armed with only his arm. Paul Anacio of the Washington Post is probably my favorite of the negatives. A movie about arm wrestling. What's next? crab soccer? And then he proceeds to mock David Mendenhall's performance and his character simultaneously, calling him a snot-nosed with a girlish giggle who has the audacity to order a tuna salad, clearly unfamiliar with the manly pleasures of an interstate trucker and arm wrestling. He caps off his summation by noting that the athletes that Hawk finds himself up against are a rarefied product of centuries of inbreeding. Damn, that's cold. In the end, though, all of this wouldn't matter. Over the Top opened February 13th, 1987, going up against the films Platoon and Mannequin, and it ended up only making $5 million on its first weekend, and it would go on to only make $11 million in total against that $25 million budget. Over the Top would make the worst of the year list for both Siskel and Ebert, not to mention garnering 3 nominations for Razzie Awards, unfairly getting 2 of them assigned to David Mendenhall, and having Stallone lose his Worst Actor Award to Bill Cosby for the dumpster fire that was Leonard Part 6. Yeah, we'll talk about that one later. Still, this was a film that would persist as a rental and showing on cable, working its way into the consciousness of many a viewer as the years roll on, cementing it as a cult film. Look, for my part, I can't tell you this is a film that's going to change your life, and I can't in any way tell you this is high art. But I'll say this, in spite of the many jumps in logic that are present here, this really is a feel-good story about a man trying to reconnect with his son. And truthfully, when you look at it from that perspective, even with all the campy and sort of goof factor involved, this film is something that is definitely rewatchable for that simple fact alone. Now, for Stallone, this was a hiccup. It wasn't the first time he had had something bomb, and he would continue to go on making films that he wanted to make. At the end of the day, he got paid. His job was done. But unfortunately, for Golan and Globus, this was just a precursor to the pain and suffering that 1987 would hold for them. Each film released this year would be its own Hail Mary, designed to try to save the floundering studio, all while they maintained that everything was fine, there's nothing to look at here. They put their hopes into banking on one Mr. Christopher Reeve after Sylvester Stallone didn't become their savior, and it would be Reeve who would be their next big ticket item to hopefully get them out of hock, desperately acquiring the rights to Superman and promising him a vanity project of his own just to keep them all afloat and keep him on board. But that's going to be something we're going to have to take up next week when we cover the build-up and the fallout from Superman 4, The Quest for Peace. The version of Over the Top screened here at the LSCE was part of a 2013 Stallone triple feature Blu-ray pack that gave the viewer Over the Top, Tango and Cash, and The Demolition Man. For features, well, there's not really a ton to speak of, but let's keep it real, you're getting 3 films on Blu-ray for $12.99 on Amazon, so in my humble opinion, that's nothing to sneeze at and well worth it. If you're a purist and you want to just get the film and the film alone, a single multi-format version can be yours for only $9.99 on Amazon as well. But again, it comes with sparse features, having only a trailer to speak of and nothing else. Still, I would tell you, you could do a heck of a lot worse. Now, remember folks, we don't get anything here at the LSCE for telling you where you should purchase your movies. We just think in this day and age, it's ever so important to continue to support physical media, so that these fine companies who own the rights will continue to release content that we all know and love. And at the end of the day, isn't that what you really want? More of the stuff that you know and love? Besides, this is a hunk of some grade A 80s cheese. And really, I can't think of a better way for a Stallone fan or a cult film fan to sit down and perhaps break bread with some new folks and screen a picture of this caliber together. So, that being said, what are you waiting for? Get out there. Get yourself a copy of Over the Top today. You'll thank me for it. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. thank you so much for joining us. We do hope to have you back next week, and indeed, all summer long, as we run through some of our favorite titles that Canon has brought us over the years. If you like what we're doing here, that would be the LSCE Dachshunds and myself, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts and hit that subscribe button, or hey, just do that wherever you're listening to us on. Did you leave us a fun review? Hell, I'll read it here and give you a shout-out on the show. Just think of it as my way of saying thank you for recognizing our love of cinema. Please swing by and check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. We've recently been added to Stitcher, so you can find us there. Give us a spin if you like. But I'm also proud to say we're on Amazon Music. So if you have an account, you can simply say, "Hey, Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured on Good Pods and Podchaser. Those are podcast databases for listeners and creators alike. Find us there, give us a follow and review if you could please, and hey, feel free to like any of the lists that we're a part of to give us a boost in the old rankings. The more reviews and those increased likes, that affects all of those marvelous algorithms, and it makes us more searchable. And then we can share more of these fine films with people. And you want to do that, don't you? Of course you do! Do you have any questions for us? Comments? Movies you want us to cover? Things you thought I got wrong? Well, we want to hear from you. Please send us an email or an audio clip to lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. Do you love social media? Well, we use it here. You can follow us on Twitter at LSCEP and on Instagram at LSCE_podcast. If you want to be even more personable or wish to contribute a segment to the sidecar, please feel free. Send us an audio message by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app to use. So, until next time, take care out there. Please wash your hands, wear a mask if you feel like it, and most importantly, stay healthy and well. And remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.